Okay, we're on the air. Okay, I want to teach you a text that I think you probably all know, at least all know the outcome of. I want to teach it to you first in a way that I think will be different and challenging, unless you already figured it out, in which case you can apply for a faculty position in a few years. And then I want to try and take, assuming we have time, I want to try and take that text a few steps deeper. And having taken the text a few steps deeper, then I want to try and show you ways in which you can use the deeper way of reading that text to create halakha in situations where there isn't yet halakha. And create it in a way which I hope does not appear arbitrary, but also is not obvious. So you have to decide, right? So it's actually, you know, maybe the halakha should be the way, maybe the halakha shouldn't be that way. Right? And then leave that as a model for you of what it is to be in the room when halakha is being constructed, as opposed to having the halakha, the halakha that's already been constructed, taught to you. Right? There are lots of areas where halakha is fairly, it's fairly finished, and there isn't so much room except for extraordinary figures to be creative. And then there's places where there just isn't halakha yet. Okay, and we'll talk about some of those places. Here we go. The issue we're going to talk about is what are the things that you have to die rather than do? Okay, and all of you already know the answer to those things, right? Because that's one of the things you learn in elementary school, right? How many things, right, are there that are Yehereg Vel Yavor? Three. Okay, right. Okay, that was a trick question if I wanted to really be, you know, because three or four or five, right, and doesn't matter whether it's public or not, but we'll say three. Okay, we'll be straightforward. And those three are? Shvichut damim bo dezara angila eriyot. Okay, I like it that you say shvichut damim, even though the Gemara sometimes says ritzicha and it makes an important difference, but for now we'll say all those. We'll say shvichut damim bo dezara angila eriyot. Okay. The Gemara we're going to learn about is how we know those things. Okay, how do we know that those are the three things that are Yehereg Vel Yavor? I want to think about is what do you think? Like, how do you think one ought to know things like this? And one of the questions you always have to ask in halacha is: suppose I knew nothing; I was just starting from scratch. What would I think the halacha should be? Why does it matter because the answer is, so there's in Midrash Halakha, so you'll find that sometimes there are things called a Binyan Av, and there are things called the Chidush. Okay, Binyan Av is when the Torah teaches you a law in one place, and we say, well, the Torah teaches the law in that place, it must be true everywhere. A Chidush is when we say the Torah teaches us the law in that place and nowhere else. How do we know the difference? What's the difference between, right, when I look at a drasha in Chazal and I ask myself, this drasha, should this drasha be a binyan av, or should this drasha be a chidush? For example, Eid Zomim, right, is a classic chidush. Right, Eid Zomim makes no sense. Why do you believe the second witness is not the first witnesses? So we say Eid Zomim chidushu, and you've been lechabo al chidusho. You can't expand the laws of Eid Zomim to anything else. So what's the difference between whether it's a chidush or a binyan av? Yes. Very nice. So there are technical things that sometimes prevent the binyan av, right? Whether you can, but shnei suvim, shloshak tuvim, good. But here we only have one pasuk, so there's no technical barrier to making the binyan av. Right? It's just by ezomim, only one pasuk. Nobody says there's a technical reason. So there's no technical reason. What's the difference between a binyan av and a chidush? Yes.
If it's going to be logically relevant in other places, then you could apply the same rules to other places. But
right, but that's nice. But then it wouldn't be. We wouldn't have to say it's a chiddush. There's no place to apply it. The whole point of saying it's a chiddush is there is a place that's logically relevant, and we're not going to apply it. Okay. Good. Yes.
I don't know if this is like the word what you were saying, but like being more of like a category and chiddush.
So you could try that and see if you could claim the binyan avs are somehow conceptual and kiddushim or not, but it won't work. But it's a nice try, and so I could be wrong. So you should go through shas after this shir and see if it's right or not, because it's a perfectly reasonable thesis. I'm going to set an alternative thesis. The alternative thesis is that a binyan av is something that you that you pretty much agree with anyway. And a chiddush is something that you think, wow, I would never have thought that. So whether a drasha is a chiddush or binyan av depends on what your premise, right? What your default setting was. If the binyan av agrees with your default setting, then okay, why not extend it? If a binyan av disagrees, so then that's a chiddush, right? That's what it means, it's a chiddush. I wouldn't have thought of it. Okay, so it's important every time you approach a law to ask yourself, right, this is because you might think, no, I'm supposed to turn my mind off and just accept what it says. But what it says depends on what you thought previously. Okay, yes, what was your question?
No, I was just clarifying. Yeah. Meaning when you approach a law that makes sense with your intuition, then that's probably that it's a binyan av and you could apply it in other cases. And if you approach it, it's not intuitive. Then...
Yeah, okay, but I cheated. So let me uncheat now. What I did was claim this is how Chazal approached interpretation of Torah. Now, the question of whether you should do the same thing when you approach halacha, which is not midrash halacha, I think it's a reasonable general extension. But it's not right. But I can't tell you that that's how, right? That's how it looks. I could, you know, we could go through lots of shavuot and see that. Yeah, look, people tend to extend halachot that makes sensible. But I used to, I read an article years ago about a process called chokification. Chokification is when a law that people used to think makes sense stops making sense. You realize, wow, I used to think that made sense. And like, I used to think, let's say, easy example. I used to think that the reason that you can't eat pig is because it gives you trichinosis. Right? But now you don't catch, right? Now trichinosis is not so that people catch, we have immunity against it. So now the law against eating pigs becomes a choke. Right. Yesterday it was a mishpat, leaving those terms for Bivrei, and now it's a chok because the reason I had doesn't apply anymore. So right. So that's right. So when you chokify something, you tend to narrow it. Right, and there are all sorts of areas where that applies. Particularly, it applies in many areas of things that women were discouraged from doing halachically. Right. There were cultures in which all of those were mishpatim. And then there are cultures where those things become chukim. And so what we do is we say, okay, the things that are halacha, we're just going to apply them exactly where they are, but we're not going to extend them because they don't make any sense to us. Okay, and over time, right? That's a process of thinking about law. Yes.
Doesn't this become highly subjective? Like one person might think it's pretty clear and obvious and should be applied to another person.
Unlike other halachic disciplines, where everyone agrees about everything. Right. So you put in like we're highly subjective, right? No, it's subjective. There is no way to escape subjectivity. Right, now, how that leaves you, right, that creates, one of my friends just talked about the epistemological abyss that people can get thrown into sometimes, right, if you can't have absolute certainty. Yeah, but the answer is yes, it allows subjectivity to enter, as does everything else. That would be my answer. Then we can talk about whether it allows more or less subjectivity, right, more rigorous, right, whether it allows more of an objective check on subjectivity than other systems, things like that. Okay, so with that as a basic background, so I'll ask you the question: if you're sitting, let's say, in an attic in the city of Lud, and somebody comes along and asks you, what are the things that you have to die rather than commit? What's your default setting? Yes. Let's not get there yet. So it's your default setting. Let's start with the first question. Yeah, good. And we'll get there. But I want to just like. I'll ask the question very broadly. Do you think that you have to justify the things that you have to die for, or do you have to justify the things that you don't have to die for? And is your working premise that, well, God commanded it, so why would I ever be allowed to violate it just to save my life? Or is your working premise, how could God command me to die? Okay, yes.
I think naturally, you have to justify, you want to justify why you want to justify why you don't have to die for something rather than justify that I have to die for something.
So you want to do that, but
want to justify why you don't have to die. But
what do you think? If you have to justify it, that means you're deep down. That's a really complicated thing, right?
Have to die.
Yeah, really complicated thing. Okay, so let's take yes.
Just like the opposite end of the spectrum is pikuach nefesh. Are we examining that in the same way? How do we know when pikuach nefesh is?
So let's start with the question, right? So how do we know that pikuach nefesh, right? So pikuach nefesh is the answer, The answer is that pikuach nefesh creates a general halachic default that, right, that you don't have to die. Okay, yes. Good. So we get to, right, so v'chai b'hem is the pasuk that teaches us that, right, that you don't, but now the question is v'chai b'hem a chiddush or a b'nin av? And it's really interesting because you look at the sugya, you'll see that there are like seven different psukim quoted. Where it says, how do we know that pikuach nefesh is doche Shabbat? And it quotes seven different psukim. And the one we accept, v'chai b'hem, is given by an amora. So it's one of those odd sugyot where we reject all the Tanaim and paskin like an amora. And, right, and it seems like nobody disagrees with the outcome. Nobody asks the question, ha'im pikuach nefesh doche Shabbos? The question they ask is, minayin pikuach nefesh doche Shabbos? So it seems reasonable to argue that actually pikuach nefesh makes sense, right? And this just happens to be the pasuk we cite for it. The pasuk confirms something we already thought, maybe, or maybe not. There are gemaras, right? And you all know that this is a question with the Maccabim, right? Right. The question whether they were allowed to fight on Shabbat or not, and they originally thought they were not allowed to fight on Shabbat, and then reality kind of struck them in the face, and somebody said, "Nah, let's fight on Shabbos." Right? It doesn't work very well. Okay, so now we have this v'chai b'hem, right? And now we're trying to figure out what are the things that are not included in v'chai b'hem, right? Right? How far does a b'nin av not stretch? Okay, so we're going to end up with three of them: avodah zarah, gilui arayot, and shfichut damim. So how do we know about avodah zarah? So avodah zarah comes from, do you all know? Where do we get the idea that you have to die rather than commit avodah zarah? So we get it from, you can look at the search sheet now, right? The Avodah Zarah Menalan, we're on the second paragraph. The Gemara says we have a brayta which seems to suggest that, right, that the Chai Bem Lo Shemut Bem, here is quoted the Rabbi Shmuel, even though in the Sugya Yuma, which is what is quoted in the name of Shmuel. So the Gemara says, Inu, the people who think that you have to die rather than commit Avodah Zarah, we're now in the third paragraph, the Amur Rabbi Eliezer, they follow the position of the Tana Rabbi Eliezer. The Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, the Hafta Hashem Elokecha B'chol Avavcha, okay, so there are actually two different ways you can get it from the words, but there seems to be a consensus that we get it somehow from the words. You should love God with all your heart. Does that automatically tell you that you have to die rather than commit a avodah zarah? No. So here again, we have a pasuk that seems to confirm something that we already think makes sense. We have to figure out why does it make sense to people that you should die rather than, right, you should die rather than commit avodah zarah. Okay, that's but epistemologically, right? Epistemologically, the big word, it means like how we know something. Epistemologically, I can say, look, but I don't have to rely on my certainty. In the end, I have anchored this knowledge in a pasuk. And if you ask me the question, if I ask you up front, like before I tell somebody to die because God wants them to, it's very reasonable to say, you need a pasuk for that. Otherwise, we worry like that, it seems too subjective. Okay, so now we found a pasuk. It's not obvious pasuk means that, but it's reasonable for the pasuk to mean that. Okay, so now the Gemara says, okay, what about Gilui Arayot? So Gemara says, Gilui Arayot, Ushvichut Damim, Kid Rebbe. So the derivation of Gilui Arayot and Shvichut Damim follows Rebbe's interpretation of a particular pasuk. What is Rebbe's interpretation? There's a pasuk that says, Ki ka'asher yakum ish arei urtzacho nefesh, kein hadavar hazeh. That just like when a man arises against his fellow and murders him, this is just like it. Okay, what is this? This is adulterous rape. We're going to, for the time being, we're going to leave the rape out of the equation and just say it's adultery, because that's what the Gemara does. And so we say, okay, so the way we know that you have to, at least the way we know that men have to, which is also a machloket rishonim, all right, have to die rather than commit adultery, is because there's an analogy drawn in the Torah between adultery and murder. Okay? So now we got Avodah Zarah down, there's a pasuk. And we got Gilui Arayot down, there's a pasuk.
So,
yeah.
Gilui Arayot is only following Avodah Zarah?
It's not, Gilui Arayot is separate from Avodah Zarah.
Sorry, I mean following murder?
It's only following murder, exactly right.
So it's conditional?
No, it's derived from murder. It's not, right, it's just like you have to die rather than commit murder, so too you have to die rather than commit adultery. Mm-hmm. Right, it's an analogy. But the presumption, right, you only know that you have to die rather than commit adultery because you already know that you have to die rather than commit murder. And here, It's not obvious that there's a rationale that you should have to die rather than commit adultery. Now here we're just relying on the verse. Right here we would say that this is a chiddush. You have to die rather than commit adultery. I say to the point, there's a machloke about whether women have to. Maybe it only applies to men. Okay, so now the Gemara says, good, so you tell me, you just taught me that I have to die rather than commit adultery because I have to die rather than commit murder. How do I know that I have to die rather than commit murder? So here's what the Gemara says. Ruseach gufeim, we're in the fifth paragraph now. Ruseach gufeim and all on. Right? How do I know that I have to die rather than commit murder itself? So the Gemara says, Svarahu. There's no pasuk. It's just as you said, it's obvious. And then we tell a story. We have a story of somebody who came in front of the Amora Rabba or Rabba, if you have a different girsa, and he said, Mari Duroya, the lord of my feudal lord, whatever it may be, said to me, Zil kat le leplanya viloka tunalach, go kill that other person or I'll kill you. And what should I do? Can I kill the other person to save myself? And the answer was, let the other person kill you and let you not, right, and you can't kill the third party. Why? Who says your blood is redder? Maybe their blood is redder. Is that what was obvious to you? Okay, interesting. You know, I was just listening to the advisory opinions podcast from a news site called The Dispatch. Which were one of the, you know, where they were debating the recent abortion restrictions. And one of the, Sarah Isger, one of the hosts said, you know, look, if there's, God forbid, there's a 3-year-old holding a gun, you're allowed to shoot them. And I said, really? That's obvious? She said, it's obvious? Yeah. No, I don't know if it's obvious. So some people it's obvious, some people it's not. How far does it go? One of my friends yesterday was saying, like, do we think this applies even, well, let's see how, right. How far do we take this rule? Okay, let me tell you what I think is astounding about this, and then we'll go try and talk about what it means. What is astounding about this is that we're telling you that there's an analogy in the Torah that only makes sense if you already have a moral intuition. You can't know that adultery is your hergel yavor unless you already know that murder is your hergel yavor. Because adultery is only derived from murder. And murder, there's no pasuk for it all. There's just a moral intuition. So there are ideas, there are moral ideas you have to have in your head, otherwise you can't get at least halacha right, maybe all of Torah right. So that's a very powerful claim, right? That there are just moral premises that are prior to Torah, or at least prior to halacha. Okay, so that's the first way. You know, so, how many of them are there? That's the only one, right? That's a really powerful. What does it mean? Does it mean, I want to argue, it means that you should be able to test everything else in halacha and say, does it agree with this or not? If you have something in halacha that is incompatible with this claim, then you should say, well, that must be wrong, because this claim is prior to halacha. We get halacha from it, not it from halacha. Right, what makes it even more astounding is that this svara, which we just said, you know, is prior to halacha and essential everything, is actually explicitly against the pasuk. Because, right, so let's take it's against a lot of halacha. Okay, so we'll take a look at the, there's one other source, which is for it, we should say, right, there's the Mishnah of Halot, which is the next source on the page, where the Mishnah says that abortion is permitted before the head of the fetus emerges, but once the fetus becomes an infant, ein docha nefesh mipnei nefesh, right? This is a direct rejection of that opinion on the podcast, right? Even though there's nothing different, obviously, about the moral intention between a fetus and an infant, whether its head has emerged or not, but you can intervene to save the life of the mother before the head emerges and not afterwards. Why? Because ein docha nefesh mipnei nefesh, because who says the mother's blood is redder than the infant's? But the mother's blood somehow is redder than the fetus's. That's a really interesting claim. Has to be worked out. Okay, but then we have another Gemara that you probably are familiar with. There's a pasuk which says v'chei achicha imach. In context, it's talking about interest, and sometimes learn it as a statement about whether you have to return interest that you charge illegally. But the Gemara then says, but there's another, the position that doesn't use it about interest in that regard uses it for a different purpose, which is a story. And now we quote a Braita, and the Braita tells you the famous story of two people walking in the desert, and one of them is holding a canteen of water, and there's a machloka between Ben Pesora, who may or may not be a real person, and Rabbi Akiva. Ben Pesora says that they should split the water, even though that way both of them will die before they get back to civilization, and let not one of them see the death of his fellow. Until Rabbi Akiva comes along and says, "V'chei achicha imach, your brother shall live with you. Chayecha kodmin l'chaye achicha. Your life precedes that of your brother." What? Who says your blood is greater than his? Yeah. Sure, but that difference has nothing to do with whose blood is redder. All right. Once I know that there's a pasuk which says that v'chei achicha imach, and I know that there's a svara which says miyemar, so I have to engage in casuistry. I have to say this is talking about this case and that's talking about that case. But if you ask me, right? If you ask me, right? Based on other biblical interpretation, is your blood redder than another person's? Yes. And yet, despite the fact that Rabbi Akiva interpreted this verse to say that you can choose your life over your brother's, Rava interpreted the verse to say that you can't, and we have to try and distinguish. So that's really interesting and complicated, right? How can we say this is a prior principle? How do we ever get this to be a svara when it's against the pasuk, and yet we still have to live with the pasuk? Yeah.
I feel like you could say that the principle, like the moral premise that you can't assume that your blood is redder than someone else's, that's what comes first, and that's like your intuition. But the drasha that Rabbi Akiva makes kind of goes against that intuition. He's saying, yeah, there's an exception to that understanding.
Good, so we could say Rabbi Akiva's drasha is a chiddush, and therefore we're going to limit it to the narrowest possible range of cases, and usually you can't choose your life over somebody else's. All right, an interesting question is going to be, what about third parties? The third parties have a right to choose one party over another. Does Rabbi Akiva say that v'chei achicha imach means, okay, right, that means you're allowed to choose among lives. And so, for example, one of my friends came to yell at me about the, because he listened to the tape of the shiur I gave yesterday, said, like, do you really think that the halacha is that you can't choose your child over somebody else's? I don't know. Do we say that the given is, right, who says your blood is redder than somebody else's? Does that mean that nobody's blood is redder than anybody else's? Is that what it means? You can't choose among lives? So let's take a look now at an article by Diana Ivan Binstock of England. It talks about a particular, actually I left out one other thing. There are two other things you should know about which seem to contradict this. One is his omission in Horios, which seems to create an order of saving lives, which includes men being before women and Kohanim being before Levim. And all sorts of things like that. And the interesting thing is that even though it's an explicit Mishnah, it seems that nobody paskins that way, and possibly that nobody ever paskins that way, even though almost nobody says that we don't paskin like the Mishnah. And it's really fascinating to read Tshuvot and have the Tshuvot explain why it is that even though there's a Mishnah in Horios that says this, we don't paskin that way. Rabbi Rachman interestingly claimed that you'll never find anybody in a code quoting it as meaning that. They always make it mean things like who gets fed first in certain kinds of situations. But contemporary poskim often get to situations and say things like, but it's not our minhag, or it would be difficult to apply it in practice, but nobody does. Almost nobody. Okay, let's take a look at how Dayan Binstock handles his case. His normal Jewish law follows the view of Rabbi Akiva. Nonetheless, there's still a range of discussion on this issue. What if neither person has a bottle of water? Instead, a third person has a spare bottle. Who should he give it to? A number of years ago, I discussed this question with Rabbi Professor Moshe Tendler, the son-in-law of the late Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, the leading halachic authority in America in the second half of the 20th century. He told me that in the 1940s, his father-in-law was telephoned by the chief rabbi of Israel, Isaac Herzog, concerning a shortage of penicillin in Israeli hospitals. Rabbi Feinstein said the doctor should give the medication to the first patient he came to who needed it. And he said, on this basis, there'll be no discrimination based on age or other health problems. Each patient is treated equally. Okay, so Rav Moshe reached the result, apparently, right? I'm sure Herzog then said it was correct. When penicillin was a rare drug and you had illnesses spreading that could be fatal if you didn't give people penicillin. So you gave the penicillin to the first patient you met, because the guiding principle in triage is not only who says your blood is redder than his, who said A's blood is redder than B. What happens if you meet two patients at the exact same time and the dose of penicillin is only enough to save one of them? Right, it's an interesting question, right? So Ben Pizarro says they split the water and they both die. Does that apply only because... Pardon? Yes, it's almost like saying cut the baby in half. Excellent. Almost like saying cut the baby in half. But Ben Pizarro might be different because there at least the water has some effect. It just happens as an external result, which is that the water's effect is going to run out too soon. Whereas maybe that dose of penicillin has no use for anybody. So what are we really, right? So the question, right, is this a reasonable outcome? And is it the necessary outcome of taking as a principle, as Rav Moshe seemed to do, that the first principle should be, and we see how Diane Binstock frames it, right, very modern language, no discrimination. All people, right? Who says one person's blood is redder than another's? So I think that, let me introduce another, let's talk about what this means, who says your blood is redder than his. So Tosfot comes up with an interesting test case. Tosfot says, when you say that I can't say that my blood is redder than yours, can I say that your blood is redder than mine? Is it only designed to restrain my self-interests? Is it designed to restrain me in third-party cases, like design me from judging people? Or is it actually an imperative? I'm not allowed to choose among lives. Tosfos holds that the logic is reversible and you can't choose somebody else's life over yours either. Right, they come with a really fancy case in which you murder somebody else by standing still. Right? So is that you can't murder somebody else by standing, right? You can't murder somebody else by standing still. Tosfos says that you can murder somebody else by standing still because you can't make the active choice. Right? The case, Tosfos' case is if somebody says, can I throw you on that baby? Right? The Chazanish says that's no good because that somebody else commits the active murder then. So the Chazanish constructs this fascinating case. I really enjoyed drawing it, where you're standing on a ledge. There's a baby underneath. It's kind of macabre, right? There's a baby underneath you. If you fall off the ledge, the baby will cushion your fall enough that the baby will die, not you, and you're standing on the ledge, and you know that you won't be able to keep your balance for long because it's too narrow in ordinary wind. So that's where Tosfos says. Chazanish says that's where Tosfos says that you are obligated to. Tosfos says that in that case you don't have to move off the ledge, and you can choose your life over the baby's. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik came along and said, no, that's wrong. You don't understand how this principle works. It has nothing to do with people. We're briskers, right? So we take all the people out of the conversation, all the things, right? Everything, right? And right, Soloveitchik famously said about his uncle that he removed all the pots and pans from Yardea. So here we remove all the people, right? What Rav Chaim Soloveitchik says, if I understand it correctly, is that what this teaches, what the simple story teaches us is that the Avera of Ritzicha and any other Avera that involves Shvichut Damim is not included in the exception of the Chayban. So it doesn't matter, right? So the specific circumstances don't matter. At the end of the day, right, what it teaches us is that we're back to saying you have to die whenever you're confronted by the Avera and the, right? So the way Rav Chaim ends up is really not about people. Rav Chaim just says that we ask the question, should the exception of the Chaybahem apply to the Isser of Ritzicha? And the answer is, since you can't know in advance whose blood is redder, therefore we have to make the decision that the law is, right, that the exception doesn't apply, and therefore you can never commit murder to save a life. Right, so Chaim is with a lumdish way of explaining it. Yes.
Question about passive and not like active versus passive murder.
Right, but so that's nafkamina, is that Tosfos says that all that matters is whether you're passive or active because you're choosing, right? And Rav Chaim says all that matters is whether you're committing ritzicha or not. Passive, active doesn't matter to him at all. All right, that's
every single case.
Right? Ezra Chai, all the question you have to ask yourself each case is this an Isser that is not included, that is not included in the Chai Bet?
Okay.
And Tosfos says, what I have to ask myself is, I can't decide, so I just have to stand still. Whatever the consequences of standing still are. Yes?
What if in that example you gave, it wasn't a baby that was pushing a pole, but an elderly person, and they said, do it, I'd rather you live than you.
So let's work on the assumption that that people, right, that in Tosfos' world, they can't say that. All right, now that relates to a much deeper question about whether you're ever allowed, right, whether you're allowed to, whether, right, whether you're allowed to be Moser Nefesh for things that are not Yerek V'Yavor. Right, and that's also Machloket Rishonim, which I don't want to get into now. Okay, yes? As long as an Isser, he's of Shrichut Damim, that's the way he frames it, right? And there's a whole debate about how what exactly that is, or it's Machloket and the Rav and his brother Ravaran Soloveitchik, about exactly what prohibitions it applied to, which we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. Well, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is a grandfather. Right, he said that it applies to all sins that are classified as having in them an element of shvichut damim, but then the question of which sins are included in that became a dispute among his grandchildren. And we'll talk about exactly how that plays out in a minute. Okay, so we're getting late, so I'm gonna have to run through a little bit. But I'll stay for a few minutes afterwards. Then you'll have my this is a good time here. Names and email addresses would be great, and then my email address is easily accessible from there as well. I'm happy to respond to questions. Okay, so I wanted to argue as follows. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, based on this logic, says the following. He says that why does Ben Pesora say that they should both drink the water? That doesn't make any sense at all. If Ben Pesora held that really you can't choose among lives, right? Before Rabbi Akiva's Drasha, that's what you should hold. You can't choose among lives. So where do you get splitting the water? So Rav Chaim claims as follows. What should really happen, according to Ben Pesora, is that you should have to hand the water back and forth. Because I can't choose my life, you can't choose your life, and the water stays undrunk and they both die. But that's ridiculous. And so there's another principle introduced in Halacha, which is that even when you have really important principles, you don't follow them and they yield ridiculous results. That's also a very important principle. Pardon?
His results still can be
seen. Yeah, maybe it's not right. So that's a great question, whether you find it more intuitive that you split the water than that they both die. Right? Is that really that much better? It depends whether you think Chayei Sha'ah count or not. But here's it, right? But other people come along and ask, but there were alternate. Why don't they flip a coin instead? Maybe that would be better than splitting it. Once we don't allow ridiculous results, why don't they flip a coin? Okay, now I want to talk about, go back to triage.
Does splitting the water, it makes sense to me because, okay, we split it, but they don't know what's
going
to happen.
Yeah, right, I understand that, right. Right. Maybe splitting the water makes sense in a way, right, because a miracle could happen, right? You could be a mirage. Could be a mirage, a helicopter could come. Yeah. He doesn't admit, right? That's the question whether the case is supposed to be real or not, or whether it's just a thought experiment. In the real world, that's true. In a thought experiment, we can imagine that there's a barrier around it that prevents helicopters from coming in, whatever it may be. It's the last bottle of water in the world, whatever it would be. You know, they'll have to hunt for 8 days afterwards to find water which has sufficient kashrus symbols on it. whatever it may be. Okay. So what Rav Moshe's triage result is essentially flipping a coin. Because it just depends which entrance the penicillin comes through. Right at the two doors here, right? So the penicillin comes through that door, you get it. The penicillin comes through that door, you get it. So Rav Moshe is essentially saying, right, that when you have that with regard to third parties, the result is flip a coin. Now, if you have a situation where you can't flip a coin, where you're already confronted by it because they're both people in the room. Maybe he would say split it. I don't know what Rav Moshe says. If you get at the moment, Rav first asked the question. The moment I got the penicillin, there were two patients exactly equidistant from me. What do I do now? Flip a coin, okay? Flip a coin or have a race, Right, say everyone think of a number between 1 and 10, whoever is closer to mine. Right, some way of introducing randomness. Does that work? Does that get us results? So on the one hand, it's really nice to have a result in which says, right, in which you don't discriminate among people. On the other hand, what if it turns out that the first patient has a kind of disease that responds poorly to penicillin? It responds, but only about 10% of patients who get the penicillin survive. And the patient across the room has a disease that 80% of patients survive. So who are you to choose? Okay, so now what would happen? So now we gave you two ways of thinking about this principle. One way to think about this principle is it's just balabatish. Front about choice between people you can't choose. Second is lumdish. It has nothing to write. The people are gone. The only question that we have to ask is, am I allowed to violate this law to save this life? Third way of thinking about it is philosophically. Okay, philosophically, and particularly, I want to argue, you can think about it in terms of the philosopher Immanuel Kant. And right, let's think about it. It can't act in such a way that expresses the value that one person is more valuable than another. What's the nafkamina? So here's the possible nafkamina. The Torah in one place says "Verapo yirape" in Parashat Mishpatim, and the Gemara says "Mikan shenitan reshus laruf el rapo." Here's what gives doctors permission. So the whole question is, why do doctors need permission? Isn't it obvious? Right, that's right. So that was a whole question among medieval philosophers often, like, why is it permitted to heal? Right, since sickness is a punishment from God, aren't you acting against God's wishes when you heal the sick? So we reject that, although there's a whole thing about the Ramban, where the Ramban seems to say something odd about whether it's l'chatchila or not. Right, maybe we really should just pray, but we live right, but because we're not on that madriga, so we allow that, right? Okay, you can read the Ramban yourself and see if you're convinced by this or not. As part of the general general progress of technology that we tend not to see that as a sensible position. So maybe doctors are allowed to use their instruments and their supplies in the most efficacious way possible. It means that doctors are allowed to be as efficient as they can be with their supplies. And then if I give the penicillin to the patient who needs it, right, who is most likely to survive because of it, I'm not valuing their life. I'm using the medicine efficiently. And even though the result is I'm making a choice among lives, right? If balabatishly, I'm choosing one life over another. But philosophically, I'm not making a claim that one life is more valuable than another. I'm using my resources efficiently. Now that is how almost all medical ethics in hospitals work now, as Diane Bensock says at the end of his article, that almost right that they end, that they distribute medical supplies in accordance with the best efficacy of the medication. So the question is that a rejection of our fundamental principle because they are constantly choosing among lives? And where this came to a head most recently was during COVID. And whether you would say, right, and so some people, Paskin, that the rule among ventilators is that the first patient who comes into the hospital gets the ventilator. And then you can't remove it. Now it turned out the ventilation didn't make anywhere near as much a difference as we thought anyway. But let's work in the semi-fictional universe at the beginning of COVID, and we thought that ventilators were really important for saving lives. So some people said that the obvious psak is that you have to read like Rav Moshe that all you can do is slip a coin, and slipping a coin means whichever patient comes in first. And other people found that extremely uncomfortable. So they did really interesting things like by claiming that a patient on their way is just as if they're already there. And so you can judge among all the patients who are on the way, and then you can give it to the one who needs it most. But okay, why can you give it even if they're all in the same time? Why do that instead of flipping a coin, right? So that created all sorts of issues. And then some people said, that's not enough. Even the patients who are statistically likely to come, you can distribute, right? Which obviously at this point they had completely rejected the notion that actually it's supposed to be random. But the challenge is, right, so once you allow this, right, so I'm arguing that you can do it in terms of, right, that the way to do it, because I'm thinking philosophically, not legally or, right, or balbatishly, I'm thinking philosophically, and I'm arguing that the Gemara is making a philosophic claim. So that, right, so I don't have to get into any of these, right, any of these complicated things. I can just paskin that hospitals can make decisions in accordance with medical efficacy. But then the question came is, but what happens if you have two people, the medicine does exactly the same for them, just one of them is 20 years old, and one of them is 80. Or one of them has another condition that will in any case likely kill them within, let's say, 2 years. We don't have to get into treifa issues. So at that point, right, what do we do? There was a hava amina in a published tshuva that actually, right, where somebody wanted to suggest, somebody may have suggested that actually you should give it to the younger patient first, or the patient with the better life expectancy first. And I sent a message to one of the students of that person saying, do you really mean that? After all, the Gemara says, who says your butt is better than his? And they said, no, they never meant that, and they changed the tshuva. So I don't know if anybody actually ever meant it or not. So I wanted to argue that that's not direct. That decision has nothing to do with the efficacy of the medication. That decision has to do with the outcomes. Right? That's a utilitarian position. Right? What's best for the world, not what does the medicine do most. But there's a counterclaim. Like, what happens if, right, does he really want to give the give the ventilator to a patient who's going to die of cancer the next day because it solves the COVID problem? And so in terms of the use of the medication, right? So every system you come up with will have challenges like this. But I think it was a significant advance to be able to think about it philosophically. As opposed to so we have 13 minutes, I'm gonna have to rush through two more things, then we'll start to the question, right? I thought it was a significant advance philosophically. To be able to think about it, it gave a way, I thought, for doctors to be able to function in good conscience, and to hold that this is the central position of the central principle, ethical principle of Judaism, is you can't choose among lives. Okay, I'll give you another example, which is a little bit more out there. We're talking about brain death. So let's assume, because it's true, that brain death isn't death. You can disagree with me. Right? Obviously, many, many people have disagreed about this. But I'll make a historical claim. The psak, the original psak, many people have since passed on different grounds. The original psak that brain death was death was based on an incorrect claim about what brain death measured. They thought it measured the complete lysis of the brain. There are no brain cells left. There's no electrical activity in the brain. That's false. Right? There is electrical activity in the brain. Actually, like no organ ever really actually dies at the time of death. That's a whole interesting question generally. You always have individual cells that survive longer. And secondly, the hypothalamus survives, which is part of the brain, but regulates the endocrine system and not the neurological system. Really interesting things. Let's assume it's not death. So I spent a lot of time on this about 5-6 years ago, I think. And at the end of the day, I concluded brain death wasn't death. And then I asked myself, so if somebody comes and asks me, am I allowed to accept an organ? Would I say, no, you have to die? Because taking the organ from a brain dead patient is murder? Because that follows. It's choosing one life. That's how you think of it. It's choosing one life over another, right? How can I choose one life over another? If it's not death, then it's choosing one life over another, and that's really evil. There's a really possibly wrong suck. The really possibly wrong suck is to say, well, it's a suffix whether it's death. So therefore, Jews are allowed to accept organs, but not donate them. Because donating them is active, and accepting organs is passive. Right, so that's the really, really wrong result. Okay, I'm just going to say that up front, right? And that's about as clear a violation of the principle that you can't choose one life over another as imaginable, even though it makes perfect legal sense. Right, I'm making the argument because it's a suffix, right? A suffix I decide right each way. Right, so that's why I'm really not taking questions for the next 10 minutes. I'm just wondering, right? That's why it makes it, right, thinking philosophically about halakha changes the psak. Because it's a perfectly good legal argument that is impossible philosophically, and you can see how Poskim, right, whether Poskim care about that makes an enormous difference. Okay, so I reached this question, and I said to myself, I don't think I could tell somebody that it was usher to live, because right by murdering by murdering a brain dead patient. That was a problem though, but I think, but I can't let say that one life is more valuable than another. So I came up with the following argument. There are two stages of the argument. One stage of the argument, which is too long to play out here, is that there is a class of people whom you can kill for their own good. And that class of people are the people whose souls are imprisoned in their bodies as opposed to inhabiting them. And I argue that that is what the language is taken from Chaim David HaLevi, the Asiyah L'Charav, and this is what the Post can call a goses zman aruch, somebody who's taking a very long time dying. Let's assume that I'm right about that, okay? Which is a big, big thing. Given that, I said, so let's see what's happening. Wait, there's another understanding of the way Kant frames what he calls the categorical imperative, the fundamental principle of ethics, is that what it means is I cannot treat one life as a means. One human life as a means and another human life, another as an end. So if I were to say that I'm taking your organs to save my life, and I'm killing you to save me, that's a violation of that principle. But what happens, which is what happens in this case, what happens if the truth is you would be dead a long time ago if I cared about you? I would have withdrawn life support from you a long time ago. The reason brain dead patients are alive is because we keep them on life support so that they can donate organs. So we don't kill them to save another life. We keep them alive to save another life. We kill them for themselves. And therefore, it's not a violation of the principle because I'm not using one life as a means to save another life. That life is already gone for all practical purposes. I'm keeping it alive to save another life. And then at such point as I don't need to keep it alive anymore, I don't. But it's not a violation of principle of using one person as a means and another person as an end. Okay, that could be another nafkamina of thinking philosophically as opposed to in formal legal terms or as opposed to in just really practical terms. And I think that there's a whole range. I've tried to make this argument in terms of what sorts of CRISPR mutations might be allowed to induce in embryos. About whether you're allowed to have physician-assisted suicide laws, right? I think that all sort of areas where there's halacha and there hasn't been halacha previously, right? We're confronting these modern questions all over. I think that taking this as a fundamental principle allows you to construct halacha and differently. Okay, so I'm going to end with one question, and then I'll give a brief peroration. I hope that the sign-up sheet is going around. By the way, if it isn't, then please make sure it's going around. Yeah, so here's one way in which you can really tell what universe your posik is living in. Is when I say the Gemara says, who says your life blood is redder than his? Do you assume that that is true even when one of the parties is Jewish and the other one isn't? Right, that's a radically different moral universe. And it changes halacha on so many things. And if you take it as a principle, right? So then if you take it as a given that the halacha is that you're not allowed to distinguish among human lives, right? And so many areas of halacha, right, have to, right? The only one kind of outcome that's okay. Whereas if you take it as a given that's only among Jewish lives, then we have the question, maybe non-Jews are also bound by this or not, right? Are they allowed to choose among lives or not? You get a totally different halacha. Okay, so it's a really important question to ask, which halacha universe do you want to live in? I'm pretty explicit. I live in the universe where I think that for it to be a svara, it has to apply to all human beings. But I understand that there are other people who don't. Some of the really interesting things are the people who don't think that and yet still have a moral instinct that makes certain outcomes impossible. Other people just don't, right? So some people are perfectly happy with outcomes saying, yeah, Jews can receive organs but not donate them. What's the big deal? Has to do with burial? So there are differences. I can't teach halacha which there are no differences among Jews and non-Jews. That's right. That's not right. There are differences. But I can teach halacha that takes it as a given that when it comes to the value of life, just as I can do the same thing in terms of gender. Right? Whether it's obvious that Mishnah Horios can't possibly relate to life-saving or it's not obvious. Right? So it's not only that there's a, right, even if you accept the argument that this is a fundamental principle, what halacha is, matter, right, changes enormously based on what you think that principle is that's supposed to be intuitive. And then, as my friend said to me yesterday, like, that's a really radical claim. Like, there are all sorts of great poskim who never got halacha right at all because they missed stage one. And everything you do is going to be wrong because it contradicts your fundamental principle, whether it yields absurd results or it yields immoral results. Okay, so what I wanted to give you is an experience of what it's like to think about halacha when the outcomes matter substantively. Right? That halacha is supposed to be right and true. And it's not just that whatever halacha says is right and true. It's that you have to test whether halacha is right and true. And arguing based on the Gemara and Chazal, that as opposed to this being my radical interjection of subjectivity into halachic process, this is actually what the authentic halachic process is supposed to be. That's how Chazal did it. Now, the right question is, but then how do we know we're doing it right, or how do we give them a decent chance of doing it right? Those are all great questions. Sometimes there's a crisis about 2 or 3 weeks into the program. But most people get through it. And it turns out that, yeah, you know, that's the right question to have, and really the only way to get through it is to do it. And then see, you know, and some of you will come out with less confidence correctly, and some of you will come out more confidence correctly. And some of you will get that wrong. That's always the risk of the system. Some people have confidence who shouldn't, and some people won't have confidence who should. But I think this is what halacha is supposed to be. I think this is what Talmud Torah is supposed to be. The outcomes are supposed to matter. You're allowed to have rooting, right? You're supposed to have presumptions. You're supposed to allow those presumptions to be challenged. You have to function in a universe in which there are fundamental principles, and yet there is a legal system that's allowed to do things that, at least for the moment, are called chukim. And so sometimes there are going to be outcomes in the system that you just don't make sense to, even though you have a drive to make sense of the system. Okay, that's what I try to teach. So if you like that, I hope you'll get all the Divrei Torah and that you'll consider applying to come learn with me. And with that, so there are lots of questions that were held up, and I have 10 minutes before I turn into a pumpkin. You had a question. Do you want to ask it now?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I was just wondering, yeah. It seems to me, maybe I misunderstood, that a lot of the post-game that rely on the idea that being passive and not making an active choice otherwise isn't considered a choice. But I would argue that even being passive is inherently.
Sure, that's a great philosophic discussion. And I argue in my Brain Death article that, actually, it's in there also, that most of the reliance on active-passive distinctions in the context of life-saving is an error. It's a misinterpretation of a Chiddush Anshei Shem, whatever, the blanking on the name, the Chiddush Anshei, whatever, the one of the posting on the side of the riff, when it was a Shibalei Halakhit, and then it becomes, darn it, armor. Sorry, not getting the word. But yeah, that's right. And it's part of the, you know, once you introduce philosophic analysis into these issues, so you'll ask kashas. That I remember was my most fond memories of yeshiva was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik giving a shiur on psikresha in a series. Right, whether it's considered psikresha, if you do an action that if you do it once is not inevitable, but if you do it 100 times, it's just the odds go to zero. God's go to 100%. So do we go by action? Right, each action is not a psikresha, but the series is a psikresha. And I had just read Bertrand Russell's treatment of causality on exactly that issue, and I was having lots of fun circulating Russell's theory of causality and how it relates to halacha about psikresha. Good questions. Yes. I think you're right. I don't think they can. But I can't. But there are poskim who do, because they take that premise differently, or because they don't think right. So two ways to do it. One is you just reject that premise, and you think that it's all the same. How do you right? Who says one Jew's blood is better than another? Or alternatively, that they think that it's okay if the mechanics of halacha yield a result that is philosophically untenable. You follow the halacha anyway. Okay. Yes, too far. And then you had a question also, right? No, you didn't have a question. So, good.
How can someone ever say something at the cost of their own?
Yeah, that's a great question. There was a famous case of an Israeli soldier who threw himself on a grenade to save it. And there's a whole book of halachic essays written in his memory of people trying to justify committing suicide to save someone else's life. And you can read them and see if you're convinced.
People did that on October
7th. Yeah, and generally, right, so there's a general machloket in that, which is what we know where it starts from, which is that there is a position in Tosfot that holds that you are always allowed to be Moser Nefesh for any Avera, right? And we valorize you for doing that, whereas the Rambam thinks that it's, right, probably that it's Aser. So if you pass in like that position in Tosfot, then it's much easier to get there.
Also, and you say that
yeah, right, so now we get the trolley problems, right? So that, you know, that's, I'll tell you a funny story, maybe it'll be funny to you, I don't know. Years ago, a prominent liberal rabbi got up at a major conference and said that he had been convinced that he couldn't deal with chosenness anymore because all human lives were infinite, and therefore all human lives were equal. And I raised my hand and said, but you know, there's machloket among mathematicians whether all infinites are equal. And no one was interested, for some reason, in debating, right, whether the claim that all human life is infinite was equivalent to the claim that, you know, that, and so even I think that it is true of all human lives individually, but you can argue, right, but it's 8 times infinity greater than infinity. Okay, good question. Yeah, right, poskim are entitled to debate that question. And as a Roy Dr. Absurdum, like, I'm willing to say 1/8, no, but 1 in a million, right, that's already hard, right? So the question of how rigorously you're willing to be philosophically, you know, philosophy also yields absurdity sometimes. And those are great questions.
And then the whole principle about the doctors choosing what yeah. would be most effective, is that the same idea for families who would send one child, let's say, away from Germany to escape Holocaust and the
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's because I don't think there's any external efficiency there. And I don't know that there's any, you know, I know that, you know, like on a formal halachic basis, I don't know any result of anything you can do other than flip a coin.
It seems like, at least from being a critic, it wasn't always a flip coin. It was like, you're the oldest, you have to
choose. That's right, because it's hard for people to live life and death, though. But the other end, right, you know, and sometimes it's you're the one I love best, right, and that we understand is evil. Right, so the question is, right, so we allow, right, so the question is to what extent we're trying to allow a certain kind of abstract subjectivity and not allow a certain kind of emotional subjectivity. But that's me. You know, my friend yesterday wanted to argue that maybe everybody should be allowed to save their child's life in front of anyone else's child's life, because that's not claiming that the life is, well, we had an argument. I wanted to argue what he was saying is, it's not that the life is more valuable, it's that the life is more valuable to me. And as long as everybody's entitled, right? But I don't know, I have 3 children, right? I have 4 children, right? I'll count in-laws, right? I have 6 children, right? You only have 1, right? So I get to save, right? It's dicey once you let that in.
And then for the idea you said that you only keep someone alive and you bring them is so that they can do the burden, is yeah. that why we keep people?
Yeah, otherwise we turn, patients whose organs are not in shape, unless the families insist, patients whose organs are not donable. If they're brain dead, we declare them dead. We take them off the machines. Right, that's one of the goals of brain death is to, right, is that's the whole debate. How much of it is, right, is because what intention is, maybe it's just a way to clear the machines for the next person, and that would be choosing one life over another. Exactly. Yes.
It's also like a question on that, on the brain death thing. You said that the issue would be with using a person's life as a means for another person's life, and that's why we can't kill somebody. But in the case of a brain dead patient, their soul is more trapped in their body. But then isn't keeping them alive also using their life as a means for another person's life?
Yes, that's a really interesting question, whether keeping them alive is also a philosophic violation. That's a really good question. I tend to think that, no, killing them is not the same thing as keeping them alive in that purpose, but I agree with you that it's a weakness in my formulation. And I got to work it out before I write the book. Very good. Very good. I agree that it's a weak formulation. Yes.
When you were dealing with like all these cases, like, were they in an author's position?
So I take that the principle you can't choose among lives is the ultimate being out. And I try to minimize the exceptions to it. My right, so whenever everything seems to be an exception to it, I always take that as a chiddush, and I take it right. That's the way I'm thinking about it.
Like the thing, you know, like you can still, it can be obvious, like, kill one person and another person, and that should be maybe like the case where like someone's brain dead or something.
That's right. And I try to write, I want to explain those cases narrowly so they don't, so they don't expand. Right? Those are the ones that always have to be explained. That's my given. All right, last chance to sign up if you haven't already. It was a pleasure learning with you all, and I hope that we'll get to be in touch and learn together again.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thank you for all the questions. Thank you. Pleasure. My wife is Mary Deborah. Yes, are you a Drisha?
I hate feeling
okay,
like
yes.
I'm not in.
Yes, that's. She kept trying to bring me in, but like, but I tried to make it went right one day that right, and I got turned back by rain. Thank you. Yes.
Your brother.
Yeah, oh, your brother Rowe. No, I thought mother. I think I do know the name. I was at Rona, right? It was a professor.
Rona, yes.
I know Aviva also, but Aviva was my student, and she teaches in some of these programs, I think, now. But not off. Oh, I don't, if I know him, I don't remember why. I have no idea. You're welcome.
I can hear. No. My father's Svi Kaplan, and my grandfather's Lawrence Kaplan.
Your grandfather's who?
Lawrence Kaplan.
Your grandfather's Lawrence. Ah, that idea, we had a whole...
Don't tell me I'm
He's eaten dinner at our house several times.
What?
He's eaten dinner at our house several times, and it was Modal Emes about a claim I made about Ish Halacha many years ago. But he also tore apart an article I wrote correctly. So... Yeah, he's very good. He's very good. That's Yichus. Yeah. That's definitely Yichus. You're welcome. Okay.